Welcome in. Thank you so much for joining us on the CCA California podcast. Good to be with you another week. Tony, how are you?
Good. How's it going? We're back. Another awesome episode.
Yeah, full house today.
Full house.
Yeah.
And it's always a good thing.
I know you've been looking forward to this one for a while.
I have, yes. There are those, you know, I love every guest we have on here.
Yes.
But there are some episodes that I really look forward to. This is one of them.
You've got a bunch of friendlies with similar backgrounds as you. Awesome. Well, thank you guys so much for joining us yet again for another week. We appreciate you hanging out with us. Without further ado, Tony, a message from our good friends at Fishing Syndicate.
Here at CCA, we are syndicated. Fishing Syndicate offers one of the best lineups of premium fishing rods designed, prepared, and built by fishermen for anglers of all ages. That's you. The FS passion shows in each one of their quality products. They design and build quality products that meet and exceed the desires and demands of all anglers, which provide maximum strength, confidence, and long-term reliability while you're out fishing. From trout to cow bluefin, there's an FS rod that'll meet your needs at a very affordable price. Don't forget, custom orders, they're available too. Visit fishingsyndicate.com to check out the lineup or visit the shop in La Habra Tuesdays through Saturdays. Don't forget to grab some of that FS swag as well. Get syndicated.
Thank you, Tony. And without further ado, let's introduce our good friend, Daniel Stutt. Daniel, how are you, man?
Hey.
Welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, man. I'll let you introduce our two fantastic guests as well for this episode.
Right on. Yep. Thanks. So here with me today, we have Russ Dunn. He is our National Policy Advisor for Recreational Fisheries. And then also Tim Sartwell over here with our Office of Comms. And I'd say he's Russ's deputy. So right-hand man there.
He actually is.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He is formerly the Deputy National Policy Advisor.
Officially.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, welcome, guys. Good to have you in studio here. Welcome to the West Coast. I'll just come out and say it. How's your trip been out here, out west?
Great. We've had a couple of really good days of meetings. We met with the Sport Fishing Association of California on Tuesday. Yesterday, we spent time with the Hub SeaWorld folks talking about recreational fisheries. And now we're here with you, and we appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, we've got a lot of stuff to get through today and on this episode. So, a question for any and all three of you. Give us an idea. What does NIMPS and NOAA and how does it work? Kind of give us just a basic understanding of how or why you guys are super important to what we do in fishing.
All right. So I'll jump on that. So NOAA is the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and it is a pretty large, multifaceted agency that provides services to the American people from daily weather forecasts, severe storm warnings, climate monitoring, coastal restoration, down to what we focus on at NOAA Fisheries, which is really the management of living marine resources. And, you know, NOAA services touch on really about a third of the U.S. gross domestic product. So we've got a long, broad reach providing services to Americans. And we have within NOAA a number of what we call line offices. So we work for NOAA Fisheries. And there's like the National Weather Service that lots of people have heard of, most people, National Ocean Service, and others. And our job at NOAA Fisheries is really the stewardship of living marine resources within what's called the U.S. Exclusive Economic Zone. So that in most places is an area from 3 to about 200 miles offshore. It's about 3.4, 3.5 million square miles, which is a lot of territory. It's larger
it's a lot
than
of territory.
The land area of the U.S. So there's a lot going on there from Maine to Guam to Alaska down to the U.S. Caribbean.
So that's your territory. That's a lot of territory to manage.
It is. And we do that in partnership with the federal council system, Fisheries Management Councils. There's 8 councils around the country out here. It's known as the Pacific Fisheries Management Council.
Yep.
And then we also do it in close partnership with the states, the coastal states and territories.
Very cool. Very cool. I mean, there's so much going on, you know, not only on a state level here in California, but also on a national level to where I mean, there's so many different, I mean, just within that territory, you've got so many different species, so many different fisheries to manage. The workload must be unbelievable.
It's large, but we have a good team, folks like Daniel. We've got about 15 folks around the country in each one of our NOAA Fisheries regional offices and our science centers. We've got someone like Daniel who is our sort of local or regional point of contact. So we certainly couldn't do it alone. And Daniel deserves all the credit for building the relationships on the ground and on the water.
Yeah, absolutely. With, there's always this talk between federal regulations versus state, how they all kind of intertwine together and all that stuff. Question for, I guess, any three of you. How does that all work? How does it all kind of fit together? What's the whole process when something changes at the top? How does that trickle down all the way down to even the local level?
You want to take that or?
Yeah, I can take it. Okay. our primary focus are federally managed species. So those primarily caught offshore 3 miles. So we do that through the Pacific Fishery Management Councils. And we do that also through fisheries management plans. So we develop them. And then use those as our sort of basis for management. You know, it lays out the framework for how we manage things. And then it varies by species. So we have a groundfish management plan, Pacific halibut, ecosystem, highly migratory species, and salmon. And we work in close coordination with the states to, you know, make sure that those are aligned for the most part in cases where those species overlap. Things like HMS bluefin, for example, we have, you can catch a daily bag limit of 2 fish that applies in federal and state waters. So we want to make it as easy as possible. So there's, no differences and confusion around that.
To step that back a little bit. So the councils that we just mentioned are comprised of recreational and commercial fishermen, state government, tribal government, representatives, academics, etc. And those are the folks, as Daniel said, who put together these fisheries management plans, the framework for ultimately the regulations that come out. So the council build those plans to try and meet the management goals and imperatives under the law. And in this case, it's the Magnuson-Stevens Fisheries Conservation and Management Act. And then the councils develop a set of recommended actions to implement those FMPs. So that's where the actual open seasons, closed seasons, bag limits, minimum sizes, and other regs are designed and built. And then NOAA takes those amendments and plans and actually then implements them through federal regulations.
Wow.
What's a typical timeline for those regulations? I mean, I'm sure it varies depending on the complexity of what they're looking at and what's to be implemented. But what's a typical timeline for these to get pushed through?
So, I mean, it seems to generally take about 18 months or so for either a plan or a plan amendment to be developed and inclusive of a set of recommended actions. And then it takes a few weeks generally for those measures to come to NOAA, to be reviewed, to make sure that they're all in compliance with the law, and then be published as a proposed rule. Then there's a comment period. So it takes another couple of months on top of the 18 to actually get the regulations in place. And there are ways around that. You can framework things, meaning you can have a set of sort of pre-analyzed actions, and when you reach a certain trigger, then it's ready to be published right away and then go into effect more quickly. But usually 18 months to 2 years is a pretty solid estimate.
So nothing happens overnight where, one year there's some kind of thing that comes down the pipeline to where we have to get this done or whatever. It's almost like a multi-year process.
Absolutely. Now there are exceptions. An ability to undertake emergency action, and that can reduce the timelines. There are other, hurdles that you have to overcome to actually qualify for an emergency and move through the process faster. Because what you have to remember is the whole process, while it's slow and cumbersome, is designed to be transparent and involve the public. And really, the U.S. has by far, I would say, the most transparent fisheries management system in the world. Public participation at every level, multiple opportunities. So it's cumbersome, but it's kind of designed that way to ensure public input.
In, I mean, I guess in other, I guess, countries and nations and all that stuff, they don't really have as emphasis on public participation and all that stuff. It's just really, that's the law.
Right. It's a much more streamlined sort of a top-down administrative mm-hmm. process than it is here in the U.S. Here, mm-hmm. it's the law was really designed to make sure that fisheries were managed by the people in a given region. That's why the council process was set up, as opposed to top down from, say, Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm. Do you, with, you know, being on the national side and all that, do you have or do you find yourself having to work with other nations on certain fisheries and offshore? I know, you know, you have the zone, the exclusion zone up to 200 miles, but are there any times when you have to work with other countries and nations?
Yeah, absolutely. Bluefin tuna that Daniel mentioned right off the bat is a great example. And there are different international bodies called regional fisheries management organizations. I used to do a lot of work on what are called Atlantic highly migratory species. So shark, swordfish, marlin, tuna, things mm-hmm. like that. And in the Atlantic, there's an international body called ICAT, which is the International Commission for the Conservation of Atlantic Tunas and Tuna-like Species.
Wow. What's that acronym?
So that's got about 83 countries that we all sit down once a year and mm-hmm. hash out regulations for all the international participants in the fishery. What tonnage can be taken by whom, how, are there minimum sizes, just like regs here, but on the international level.
Wow. That's crazy stuff. I mean, specifically when, let's kind of narrow it down to the West Coast here. What kind of things, and Daniel, this is probably more for you, we'll get into a little bit of rockfish at the end here and all that, because I know that's the hot topic right now. But what other kind of, you know, projects are you particularly working on the West Coast, and what can we expect?
Yeah, definitely. So Russ mentioned, I think, that we are working on a policy, so we rolled that out. I don't know if you want to touch on that really quick, and then I can pivot back to sure. some of the regional projects.
Yeah, so we have what's called the National Saltwater Recreational Fisheries Policy. Mm-hmm. And it sounds bureaucratic because it is. And every big institution runs on policies and plans, right? And mm-hmm. so we're no different. We had to play that game.
Yeah.
And we updated it recently this past September. We went out, we had a long, lengthy 6-month comment period for the public for inputs. We held in-person meetings and webinars and comment portals and whatnot, and updated that really to include a couple of new goals in the policy. So right now there are sort of 5 basic goals in the policy. First and foremost, it's ensuring the health of the resources on which recreational fisheries depend, right? If you don't have good resources, you don't have good fisheries. Second is really promoting inclusive participation in the fisheries, and not just the fisheries, but in the management process as well. We want to make sure that the real breadth of voices are represented at the table. Next is making science-based decisions, right? Conservation and management, we're a science entity. It's a heavy science-heavy industry and sector, and so that is a key aspect. And then what we added recently were advancing climate-ready initiatives. So we need to know and understand better what is climate change is driving in terms of changes to the water. And then finally is strengthening our focus on inclusivity and equitable treatment of folks that have been historically underserved or underserved communities.
Hmm. Interesting. Interesting.
Yeah. So on the West Coast, you know, we've taken that and created a regional implementation plan to implement some of those, you know, policy objectives and guiding principles. And yeah, we've got a lot of things in the work right now. You know, engagement is a high priority. So we've got, you know, Day at the Docks coming up here on April 7th.
Yep. Sunday.
On Sunday. Yep. So we'll be there. Meet, you know, myself and people from the Southwest Fishery Science Center. Owen's going to be there. So you got a chance to ask him about bluefin and
Owen, that guy.
Yeah. And then we'll also be at the Ventura Fairgrounds in early May, the West Coast Outdoors and Sport Fishing Show. So the sport fishing shows are great to get
a lot
out.
Of outreach.
Yeah, a lot of outreach. It's been
I mean, outreach seems to be super important, especially with anglers and all that stuff. How does it really kind of measure up at the, on the NOAA side as far as the priorities and everything?
So outreach and engagement are one of our key priorities. If you aren't out talking to people, you're not going to understand what their priorities are, what their needs are. And so we really focus on that, both as a headquarters program, but also through our regional coordinators. But it's certainly something that, you know, we saw as we were talking a little before we actually got on air here about COVID and had an effect of sort of eroding some of the relationships just because people didn't see each other, talk to each other for mm-hmm. a couple of years. And now we're really doubling down, trying to strengthen those relationships back to what they used to be.
With, you know, with COVID happening and with the ability of technology coming and the invention, basically the creation of Zoom and virtual meetings and all that stuff, have you seen a lot more engagement from the public and other organizations?
You know, it's been interesting. We're seeing a slightly different kind of engagement. We're seeing folks that may not have engaged on national level stuff now jump into national calls through webinars and things. And I think the councils, for the most part, have seen an increase in participation and viewership, where prior to COVID, there were just a handful of councils that were doing webinars or, you know, streaming their meetings, and now most or all of them do. And there's, I think they've all noticed a big uptick.
Nice, nice. Going back to the national plan for a little bit, you know, you mentioned quite a bit of goals and all that. Where does access kind of fall into that?
Yeah, access and opportunity are one of our sort of key focuses. We know that rec fishing is all about the opportunity to get out there and be on the water. And, you know, NOAA's and the council's job are really to try and find a way to balance access and opportunity with the sort of conservation mandates of the law. And so it's something where we are always looking for ways to ensure continuing access or mitigate if there's a more restrictive measure that needs to be put in place for conservation purposes. How can we minimize the impact on anglers and to make sure there's as much opportunity as possible?
Very cool. Very cool. With, you know, obviously a big focal point in California especially is this thing called 30 by 30, which I'm sure you guys are aware of. You know, on the NOAA side, how does that really kind of affect you and what you do, or how would that affect going forward, you know, as we approach 2030?
So the 30 by 30 effort for at the national level falls under a Biden administration program called America the Beautiful. And it's just one aspect of that. And I think one of the key points that has made that successful is as the administration rolled out that program, they specifically looked at conserving those resources and that those areas for recreational opportunities. So it was not, I would not call it a preservationist approach, but more of a conservation and wise use sort of approach. So they're very cognizant of the fact that while there's a goal to protect 30%, it needs to be protected for a reason. And that those reasons include the opportunity to get out and make use of those spaces.
Yeah, perfect. I wish it was more so like that in California, but you know, with the nature of our business, it's not so much. Going back with the angler partnerships, we'll call it. You know, there's the council meetings. There's a whole bunch of, you know, Fish and Game Commission meetings, Coastal Commission meeting. I mean, you name it. There's a meeting every single week and every single day, it seems like. What are some, you know, really very minimal and easy ways for anglers, like just normal anglers like myself, to really kind of get involved with the process, stay up to date with what's going on? And, you know, even with the outlook almost 18 months to 2 years ahead of time, how does one stay up with that?
Yeah, I'd say, you know, first off, reach out to me or anyone from our West Coast Rec team.
There's... That's right. You gave out your personal phone number the last podcast.
I did.
That was gutsy, man. Uh-huh. Did you get any weird phone calls at like 12 at midnight or whatever?
No. Okay. Not really.
All right.
But yeah, so I send out newsletters on a fairly regular basis to kind of keep people, you know, up to speed on what NOAA is doing. When these council meetings come up, you know, what actions might be taken. Yeah, there's just, like you mentioned, so many opportunities. And so, you know, if you reach out, let me know what you're interested in. I can point you to those, you know, particular next steps where you might be able to comment. You know, you mentioned like during COVID, we've seen an increase in online opportunities. And so I have seen like an uptick in public comments submitting in the council meetings, which is great. You know,
stopping you right there. Yeah. Good or bad?
Oh, I think it's great.
Yeah.
It's good. Yeah. We want to hear feedback. And it's interesting because you do see like so many people, you know, selecting different options like, hey, you know, option one might be better for me and in my area, or option two, you know, I want to support that. And so, yeah, it's good to see like that balance and like the different considerations so we can, you know, analyze all those different objectives.
The word that comes to me is collaboration, mm-hmm. collaboration between the public and, you know, the government and also NOAA as well, to where, you know, working on certain, you know, whether it be policies, rule changes, reg changes, whatever, collaboration seems to be the word that I come up with. And, you know, I think overall it's a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was clear to us right from the get-go that the only way to really make this system work and provide excellent service to the rec community is through cooperation, collaboration. There's no silver bullet out there for any fisheries issue. Everyone has a different opinion on how it's going to affect them or their involvement in recreational fishing, be it a for hire guy or a private guy. And so we realize collaborating with rec communities, like in groups with like CCA and others, is the only way to make it work.
Speaking of CCA, you know our good friends from our national organization, Pat and Ted, and
yep,
all that.
Yeah.
You know, CCA specifically and all that. How much do you get to work with those folks and obviously Wayne and Mark Aralnick and those guys?
Yeah, a fair amount. You know, I tend to deal more with the national level folks or the large regional organizations, and so you know, we are regularly receiving inputs from CCA National, either via, you know, discussions and phone calls or comment letters. And often, you know, CCA is really good about building a coalition, speaking of collaboration, mm-hmm. With the other sort of national recreational interest groups like the American Sport Fishing Association and others. And so we regularly meet with them in a sort of group setting and hear their priorities.
And how important is it for groups like ASA, CCA, and others to really just be kind of all, you know, building that coalition, building that partnership and all working together? How easy or how much easier does that make your job?
Yeah, it's really, when a community speaks with a unified voice or a fairly unified voice, it makes it much easier. It's much easier to find that win, so to speak, right? If you have a fractured community, and frankly, and I've been doing this a long time now, about 25 years I've been in recreational fisheries. And back in the late 90s, early 2000s, the rec community was fractured. I mean, it was across the country by sector, but even, you know, within states, there was no strong sort of unified voice. And in the last 15 years, that has really come together strongly, and CCA and others are part of that, and really sort of leaders in trying to help steer government policy, both at the state and federal level.
Good. That makes me feel good. Being part of CCA California, and kind of we all kind of have our own piece to play, whether that's our organization or the rec angler or whatnot. Everyone's involved. Everyone's involved collaborating. When it comes to, let's kind of move into, you know, council process and all that stuff. I know there's a whole bunch of, especially in the Pacific, the PFMC, Pacific Fishery Management Council, there are some seats that are coming up and there's always seats that need to be filled and all that. You know, speaking more so for like the rec guys or the recreational angler, the typical angler rather than, you know, CCA, how does one get involved? How does one, you know, and ultimately end up either on the council or in an advisory council seat or whatnot? I mean, there's so many different seats to sit in, but how does one end up involved like that?
So there, as Daniel was saying, there are a lot of opportunities at the public to participate, from sort of sort of the public comment periods during a council meeting. You know, anyone can go and just and provide their inputs and their comments. But then, as you said, there's various advisory bodies that are always looking for knowledgeable people to come and sit. And they, and you essentially really just apply to the council for an open seat. And then they'll review the applicants and pick the folks that they feel are most appropriate. Those are all volunteer. There are public comment opportunities on the proposed rules. Once the council hands off their preferred package to NOAA to actually like have it codified, there's comment periods within that. And so there are a ton of opportunities. But in terms of specifically getting on the council, that's a fairly straightforward process, but it's really defined in the law, in the statute, that Magnuson-Stevens Act. And essentially what happens is the governor from each state identifies three candidates, a minimum of three candidates for each potential council seat that they are trying to fill, and then submits those to the Secretary of Commerce, who then reviews those through a couple of different lenses, right? The council, I mean, the secretary needs to make sure that the council has an appropriate balance from rec, commercial. We want diversity on those, on the councils, both gender and ethnic diversity, and a wide range of just perspectives and knowledge. And so once the state, the governor provides those, it's just a review process and then a set of appointments that come out at the end of June each year.
Wow, very cool.
And there's different advisory bodies that, you know, consist of commercial and recreational anglers from the different states and different sectors. So, you know, you can reach out to, you can apply for those positions. Mm-hmm. They come up every, I think, 2 or 3 years maybe, and I send out notices on those. And then even if you're not selected to be on that advisory body, you know, reach out to that member. He's there to represent you. Mm-hmm. So you can, you know, his information's public or their information's public. You can always email, call them before meetings. They can fill you in on what, you know, they're discussing sort of in those, like, GAP meetings or the MT or the AS meetings. So
I was going to say, and there's like GAP, there's HMS, there's groundfish, there's all kinds of salmon.
Yeah.
I haven't even talked about salmon. All different spots that need to be filled too.
Exactly. Yeah, there's a lot of opportunities there. And, you know, just find something that interests you. If you like rock fishing, then, you know, talk to the GAP. That's the Groundfish Advisory subpanel. Mm-hmm. You know, you like tuna fishing, reach out to the HMS Advisory subpanel. You know, you can kind of narrow down your focus because, yeah, like you said, there is like so much going on out there at one time.
Even though it's volunteer, are there, you know, for all these seats, are there term limits, you know, is it a yearly thing? You can, you know, if you get approved and you're on there, can you, you know, try and stay another year? Like what's that process like? Can you go in and out?
I think it's maybe a 2 or 3 year term limit.
The council seats themselves for actual council members are 3 year terms, and you're limited by statute to three year terms. And then you have to take a break. You can come back after that, but you gotta have a give it a pause.
Yeah,
because we want, you know, new blood and new perspectives in there. But
yeah,
in terms of the advisory panels, that's not defined by statute, and so each council sort of puts together its own SOPs, standard operating procedures for how those work.
Nice. You know, we've often said, you know, here at CCA California and all that, that we've always discussed with everyone, whether it be the anglers themselves, other groups that, you know, oppose a bunch of what we do and all that. We're trying to paint this picture of fishermen are not the enemy. We're good conservationists. We're promoting conservation. We're trying to do the right thing for the resources and all that stuff. When it comes to that phrase, fishermen not being the enemy, you allowing the opportunity to participate in all these processes, you know, whether it be council, advisory bodies, or anything like that, it certainly seems like, you know, you guys would probably tend to agree with that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, fishermen are the first ones, be it commercial or recreational, who understand if that resource isn't there and in good shape, there's no future in it. We either doing it for fun or for your livelihood. And yeah. So, you know, certainly there are times when we're not all on the same page. There's no question.
It's human nature.
But, you know, a lot of times it comes down to concerns over the data and, you know, where we use and are required to use the best data that we have that's out there. And sometimes there's a lot of uncertainty in the data. So you have to make your best judgment. And whether it's conservationists or the fishing community, sometimes there are disagreements about what do we do now when we have some uncertainty around a data point.
Speaking of the data, when it comes to NOAA and the collection process, collecting all that data and everything, are the processes being improved upon in time and all that, or being worked on or whatnot? You know, are they being, you know, really watched and managed correctly and everything?
So data is one of our biggest challenges right now. And actually, so my office is teaming up or has teamed up with our Office of Science and Technology to really re-envision what we call the state, regional, federal data partnership. And there's a need to go back and revisit the roles of each of those entities in this process, how we do it, what are the responsibilities, and improve the data systems and the collection and flow of data. So it's a huge issue. And I know out here there's been some recent certification of programs. I'll ask Daniel to touch on that. But so it's a constant process of trying to improve. And I think that's one of the things that makes people a little bit uncomfortable is science is a process, right? And so when you find that something needs to be improved on, you have to make a change, and change makes people uncomfortable.
Interesting.
Yeah, so Russ mentioned the certification. So our Marine Recreational Information Program, they published national data standards, and now all of the, you know, different data collection programs are going through the certification process to make sure that, you know, they're, you know, qualified under the standards or certified under the standards. And so, yeah, we're starting to do that on the West Coast, and those are filtering in and, you know, being approved. And yeah, not expecting any, you know, major changes to those programs under the new standards. We've got, yeah, really good relationships with the states. They collect all of our state data out here that we need. So, you know, you'll see the dockside samplers. I just want to highlight the importance of recreational anglers for, you know, talking to those dockside samplers and, you know, communicating your catches, letting them measure them. The biological information is really important as well. You know, like you were mentioning, like data is a constant challenge. You know, looking at some of the stock assessments, they publish a research and data needs. And so it's good to go back and look at those and see where we can improve and get new data collections. You mentioned, you know, how can anglers get involved? We've teamed up with some of the charter boat captains out here in California specifically, where we're lacking some of the age data and other biological data. And so we partnered with them. They're going out, taking anglers on trips. We're getting samples and sending those back to our Southwest Fisheries Science Center lab, where all that data can then be analyzed and used in future assessments, which is really critical because, you know, we're dealing with some challenges out here with some stocks like, you know, copper and quillback and, you know, and all that feeds into uncertainty or certainty in the stock assessment. You know, having more data, better data means more certain stock assessments, you know, a little less uncertainty buffer means more fishing opportunities. So, yeah, it's really, really important for us to work and share our data that from the fish that we're catching.
Yeah, Tim put it well the other day. Management is only as the good, only as good as the data that it is based on. Mm-hmm. And you know, one of the things that Daniel just touched on was, and you mentioned earlier, was the cooperative nature of the relationship and the sampling that's going on in these for-hire vessels is fantastic. It's a really robust program. The anglers love to do it. They love to catch the fish and hand it over to the scientists. The scientists are right there taking the otoliths out, taking samples, measuring it. The captains are reporting the data right then and there electronically. And so the captains love it because the customers love it. We love it because it's filling data gaps. The rec community writ large loves it because it's helping to reduce some of the uncertainty. So it's really a win-win program that Melissa Monk, our colleague at our Southwest Fisheries Science Center, has put together with a whole team of folks, and it's a great program.
I was just about to say, Russ, it's a win-win-win. Everyone wins.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
And I'm sure probably the relationship with SAC has a lot to do with that, where, you know, providing boats and staff and all that stuff too.
Yep, definitely coordination and all that, yeah.
I mean, what other opportunities are there for, you know, citizen science? I mean, we have the white sea bass program over here, and we can't stress enough how important it is to donate those heads. Or, you know, they're rolling out that fin clip program this year as a pilot program. But it goes without saying. I mean, what better opportunity do you have to supplement data for the better potentially than to contribute to citizen science? So what are you familiar with, any other local programs that, you know, the recreational angler that's not going out on a sport boat can participate in?
I'm not on the West Coast. I'm not on the East. I can speak to a little bit on the East Coast, where there's some similar fin clip programs. Also, one of the programs that we just supported last year, we found some funds to help bolster our tagging program. So our Southeast Fishery Science Center covers the Gulf of Mexico and the Southeast U.S. And they needed more tags and tag kits, et cetera. And they want to expand, or are expanding, their program with the funds that we gave them, from just highly migratory species to sort of coastal pelagics as well, mahi and things like that. And so that's been a big success. And actually, I know that they were going to send some tags out here to the Southwest Center to try and supplement their supply for billfish tagging.
That's all interesting.
Those tags aren't cheap.
Yeah.
Well, these aren't the satellite tags. These are what we call the spaghetti tags. So these are little strips of paper. We have funded organizations like the International Game Fish Association. Mm-hmm. Our program was able to provide them with some satellite tags for billfish. And, you know, those tracks are really invaluable. And it's just, whenever we can find money to help supplement or support citizen science, it's one of our big priorities.
Nice. I do have a note here. It says habitat and conservation. Those obviously are two big priorities for us, for CCA and all that. Can you speak to a little bit of, you know, any programs or whatnot promoting both?
Sure. So one of the projects that we do is every 4 years we hold a national summit. We bring about 200 leaders in from all around the country and discuss priorities of the day. And a few years ago in 2018, an issue that really rose to the top quickly was habitat, because it's a pretty straightforward issue. No habitat, no fish. Everybody gets that. Everyone understands that. And it's another example of a win-win. And so one of the programs that our office supports, we teamed up with our what's called the Office of Habitat Conservation. We provide grants to local projects that directly engage fishermen. They either directly by fishermen or with fishermen, and to conserve and restore habitat. We've done about 14 projects, local projects around the country the last couple of years. There's been one here in California 2 years ago that did seagrass, I think, in Orange County. And so we get a double benefit of that. The anglers engage, they're participating, they have ownership of it, and the habitats are improved. And then in terms of conservation, you know, we've been a big supporters of both circle hooks and shifting to circle hooks and using descending devices. And over the last 10 years or so, we've given about $1 million worth of descending devices to the various interstate fisheries commissions, like the Pacific States Marine Fisheries Commission, or states and anglers, to be distributed to anglers at tackle shows and things like that, to help improve the conservation status.
Nice.
Out here on the West Coast, we've distributed 20,000 descending devices over the last 10 years.
We probably had a big chunk of that.
Probably 70,000 ID guides.
Yeah.
You know, that's really important as well. We supported development of a fish ID app as well, put out by WDFW, but obviously applicable to West Coast wide as well.
Mm-hmm. In terms of descending devices and all that, we obviously, you know, we use them out here for, you know, primarily ground fish and all that, but out, like say out east or in the south and all that, how effective and how great have they been for other species?
Yeah, so out east, it's really what for us, it's the quote-unquote snapper grouper complex, which is really the biggest beneficiary of those. And now, you know, it was seen as effective enough where both the South Atlantic Fisheries Management Council and the Gulf of Mexico Fisheries Management Council have mandated their use. And so you have to have it rigged and ready on board. You have to have a rod dedicated to it and ready to go if you're out fishing for snapper grouper.
Okay, awesome. And the data seems to show that they've been pretty much effective.
Yeah, they seem to be very effective. And actually, so now there's been a number of studies recently on sort of predation of fish being returned, because that was a big concern. Are the dolphins picking them off as they go down, or the sharks, et cetera? And there was real concern, but the latest couple of studies we've seen show that it's a very low rate of predation on those, on the order of 1% or 2%. And so we're continuing to do those studies, but it really looks like it is a much lower rate of post-release consumption, if you will, than we were concerned about.
Nice. That's good to hear. That's really good to hear. You know, before we let you guys go, I can't believe it's only been an hour. We got to talk a little bit about fishing. Do you fish back at home?
I do. I do. With the kids, my son is a huge fisherman. He's actually about to graduate from college and wants to get into the fishing world, wants to be a guide. Okay. So, yeah, he's a much better fisherman than I am.
What kind of species that do you guys go after?
We mostly do inshore, so snook, tarpon, red drum, weak fish, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So we're mostly inshore, but it's just not big enough to really get offshore to the bigger snapper group. But you're always coming across snappers inshore as well, fishing around the bridges. You get some big groupers, some of the big Goliaths and whatnot. So it's a great, if you haven't fished in Florida, you need to come there. The species diversity is amazing.
I've heard so many things. Have you been to Florida, Tony?
I have been to Florida once. I saw manatees for the first time. I almost cried. I thought they were amazing. And I have attempted to fish, but I have yet to be successful. But I only went out for like a couple hours with some friends that were over there. So I can't really say that I've fished in Florida, but I have been on a boat in Florida.
Okay. Fair enough. Russ, have you fished out here yet?
I've done a couple of West Coast trips on some of the headboats. In some cases, was actually demonstrating the sending devices and whatnot. And then last time we were here was a year ago or so with a federal advisory committee, and we took them out on one of those sampling trips that was supported through SAC. It was great. The bosses got to see how it works, how the whole system worked, and have become big advocates and supporters for the program.
Nice. Very cool. Do you have any other plans coming out west here anytime soon? Got to get you on a boat, go fish.
I think we've got some out to Hawaii coming up, some trips.
Oh, that's really
nothing,
west.
Nothing here.
You're passing us by there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Daniel, the time has come. We can't let you get out of here without talking a little bit about Vermilions and what's going on. And
take a deep breath.
Yeah. Take a deep breath. Take a sip of coffee, all that stuff. Let's get into it. You know, obviously with so many changes, with so much, I don't want to call it pressure, but a lot of anxiety with groundfish, with what's happening, what's going to happen, what could happen and all that. What do you have to say?
Totally, yeah. So, you know, like we were mentioning earlier, for groundfish, we try and set things on a two-year basis, biennial basis, kind of make things consistent a little easier. We got some, you know, new information. The council was discussing it at March, and they saw that, you know, we are projected to fish over the species-specific contribution, the limit, basically, and so they had to take some action for us to reduce the bag limit for vermilion. So it's projected to decrease our harvest by about 20%. They took action on the commercial fishery back in November to decrease their harvest as well. And so that's going to really put us in that, you know, back in that sustainable range for now. And and so I think the last assessment on that was in 2021. So we have some pretty good data on that. It was just showing that unfortunately we were just kind of catching them too much a little bit. So taking a step back on there. And so, yeah, kind of threw some of the seasons off a little bit. You saw some of the offshore, inshore 50-fathom line and the 20-fathom line a little bit. Unfortunately, yeah, we had to do it right before the April 1st opener down here, so it kind of threw a wrench in. But we were able to get our changes in before that deadline, which was nice. The council made the decision in early March. We were scrambling to put together the rule package, get that off to headquarters, and then get it published. And then also the Fish and Game made some recommendations as well, so you'll see those changes consistent with ours, essentially. Mm-hmm. And I believe they also implemented a requirement to have the descending device on board, rigged and ready to use, potentially.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of what's going on. We've
as much as it is doom and gloom, especially here on the West Coast and everything, with, like, for example, the Vermilion going down to 2 and everything, I'm a big believer of, doing the right thing right now so we can have plenty later on or whatnot. From your perspective, is there a way or is there a reality to expect where, if we suffer a little bit right now, we might get it back in the future or get credit for it at least in the future?
Yeah, I think they consider that when they're doing the stock assessments or looking at, future projections of, the stock status. They take into account the most recent catch limits when they do those, like, updates or the full assessments, things like that. So it will, come back to, help you in the future, essentially. Mm-hmm.
With, Russ, with the Vermilion and all that, on that specific issue with groundfish here on the West Coast, is that pretty up there in terms of priority on the national side or on the national scale, or are there far greater issues that somewhere in another part of the country that are really taking precedence?
It certainly has, its profile has been elevated in the last few years, which is a good thing because then there's more focus and more dollars coming towards it, like for the cooperative research that we just talked about. Mm-hmm. I'd say in general, probably the hottest continuing topic is the fish that shall not be named, which is red snapper. it is omnipresent, and it is, it's both in the Gulf of Mexico and the South Atlantic Council jurisdictions. It's two different stocks, and so it is by far the most popular of the federally managed species in the Gulf and high profile, and there's just a ton of pressure on that. But I think the Vermilion and the copper and quillback out here issues have definitely, are on the national radar for mm-hmm. sure.
Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah. And I think one thing too, that we're trying to take away is, we need better communication on that front. We saw the harvest happening over this certain limit. We needed to probably communicate that a little better. And so we're working, with our RecFin group to make some of that data a little more accessible. It's out there for, public that can download it, check out, all the latest catch limits catch effort. And we're trying to take that and compile it in a format that's really easy to understand and, readily available to use. So
do people know what RecFin is?
Not sure. So RecFin, Recreational Fisheries Information Network, that is like our state federal partnership. They are the data warehouse for all of our state and federal data, essentially. And RecFin is recreational focused. There's PacFin, which does all the commercial stuff. And so we're trying to work actually with PacFin as well to get some of their data because they have warehouse some of
that. And it stands for Recreational Fisheries Information Network.
Yeah.
Right.
I got that. Yeah. RecFin.org.
We have the opportunity to work with so many volunteers. And I think one of the most common, observations is there are so many acronyms in the government world.
The whole way up in the car ride, Tim was saying, no acronyms, no acronyms. So I'm trying to not use
them. No. It's we even had to build like a guide for all of our volunteers during meetings and all that stuff. It's actually, Tony, you put it together.
I I put something together and I probably missed about 80%, 90% of the acronyms out there, but I tried to put the most commonly used and the most colloquial names. I tried to put on that list to make it as comprehensive as possible, but I know I missed a lot.
Well, before we let you guys go, anything new or exciting coming up in 2024 that we need to be aware about? Any programs or anything that we need to be on the lookout for?
Yeah, we've got some fun stuff coming up, and Daniel's going to participate in this. Tim has been working with the National Park Trust and the Office of National Marine Sanctuaries to put together a series of sort of family fishing opportunities supporting both veterans and what often are Title I schools, so those schools in the poorer districts. And it takes these kids out. They learn about marine conservation. They learn about fishing. And for many of them, even though they live in coastal communities, it's often their first time ever out on the water. And so we had a really good program last year with three events. This year we've expanded to, I think, five events. And it's a great opportunity coming up. And I think there's one that's going to be in Monterey in July 27th or something like that. Yeah.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, before we get you guys out of here, how do we get involved? How do we get in touch with you guys, all the websites, all the good stuff?
Yeah, I'd say sign up for our newsletter. Email me. I already gave you out my phone number.
do you want to do that again?
Daniel.stutt, S-T-U-D-T at NOAA.gov. It's the best way to get in contact. Mm-hmm. My information's out there.
You can get me at russell.dunn@noaa.org. So it's russell.dunn.
Cool. Awesome.
.gov. What did I say?
Org.
Oh, sorry. .gov. I was actually intentional. Keep going.
Oh, man. Well, this has been fascinating, guys. Thank you so much for coming in. I think the overall message on this one is really just to get involved on, whether you're an angler or someone that's really involved or interested in GR stuff. There's so many different outlets to get involved. You should do it for sure.
And your voice can be heard. A lot of these are public outreach, public forums,
meetings.
If you have a couple hours out of your day and it coincides with a meeting time, hop on and just get as educated and try and get as much information as you can. I think as fishermen, like, we have to be educated. It's one thing to go out and fish and take, but if we're not educated on the resource and everything that's going on, you want to make a positive contribution in some way or another. So there's plenty of opportunities for people to hop on Zoom, to email. Use your resources.
and don't be afraid to get involved because you don't think you know enough. Everyone out there has some experience on the water. Everyone's trying to do the right thing, and your opinion matters. And your knowledge, you have more knowledge than you realize. So don't be afraid that you don't have a PhD and you feel like you can't contribute.
Everyone has to start somewhere. Absolutely. Tim, it's good talking to you, man.
Hey, it's great. Great to be here.
Oh, man. Well, seriously, thank you guys again so much for joining us today. It was
thank
awesome.
Thank you. Thanks. Appreciate it.
Yep. Tony, fascinating.
As oh, this always. Was awesome. I hope the listeners, they really absorbed as much as they can. I mean, the process alone, fisheries management, it's not a clear cut, it's not a clear cut road. Mm-hmm. And it's multifaceted. There's a lot of turns, twists and turns, and it's not an overnight process. Yeah. These are things that take sometimes years that people can be on top of, but don't get executed until later. So this was awesome. Thank you guys for being here.
Yep. Thank you guys. And thank you for joining us this week. We appreciate all of you hanging out with us, and make sure to go follow us on Instagram at CCA California. Make sure to go visit us on our website at ccacalifornia.org. And we will see you guys next week. Take care.